All right. I am calling this meeting of the House Special Committee on Energy to order. Today is Tuesday, February 14th, Valentine's Day. And the time is now 10:16, according to my clock. We're joined by Representative Carrick, Representative Shragi, Representative McKay, Representative Prox, myself, Chair Rauscher. I don't see any other legislators in the room today to introduce, so I would also like to thank you, House Record Secretary Jordan Wright, and LIO moderator Sydney Truitt. Do I have them backwards? Got them right this time? All right. For all they do for this committee. Before we begin, I'd like to remind the members of the committee, people in the audience, to silence your cell phones and any other personal electronics. We're going to see a slideshow, so I just ask that you hold your questions to the end of each slide and direct the members if you're going to talk to the testifiers, direct your comments and questions to the chair, and the testifiers identify themselves for the record before speaking. With us today is Curtis Thayer, the Executive Director of Alaska Energy Authority, here to introduce Brian Hickey, Executive Director of Regional Rail Belt Coordination. Interesting. I never knew that's what that C stood for. Okay, before we get started, are there any questions? Mr. Thayer, I believe, is online. And Mr. Thayer, are you there?
Yes, I am.
How you doing? Mr. Thayer, you have the floor if you would. Identify yourself for the record, and you have the floor for the time.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Curtis Thayer, and I serve as the Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority. And I appreciate the time today, and I appreciate Brian for making the trip to Juneau. One thing I think is very important with this hearing and the hearing we had with the utilities earlier our last month, and that is to say that there's historic alignment among the utilities. Not necessarily 100% agreement, but we do have alignment among us all, whether that be Homer Electric, Chugach Electric, Matanuska Electric, Golden Valley Electric Association, Seward, and the Alaska Energy Authority. And this alignment revolves around the rail belt and the need to upgrade the rail belt. AEA owns the largest hydro project south of Homer, and that provides 10% of the renewable energy on the rail belt, not only just for the rail belt utilities near it, but all the way to Fairbanks. 17% of the power from Bradley goes to Fairbanks. So it's across the state. And one of the things that we've determined and we've done, and that is in order for us to move and add additional renewables and decarbonize the rail belt, we need to start in the southern region in Homer and work to Anchorage, and that is upgrading the transmission lines. We cannot increase Bradley. We cannot increase Bradley Lake. We can't add solar or wind or tidal on the Kenai Peninsula to serve the rail belt grid without upgrading these lines. And to that matter, the utilities with AEA bonded $166 million this past summer, or this past fall, actually. And this funds available does not raise the rate to ratepayers, and it does not cost the state treasury any funds. This is using excess payments after the bonds were paid towards Bradley for required project work deemed by the Department of Law. And these upgrades to the transmission lines are starting now. We're already removing the 69 kV line by Cooper Landing, but these projects are going to cost close to $1 billion. So the 166 is a step in the right direction. And today what you'll hear from Brian is opportunities and what we're looking for as the rail belt, and looking at the GRIP, or the Grid Resilience and Innovation Partnership, which is funding available through the infrastructure. There are three GRIPs, 1, 2, and 3, which Brian will explain and where we're at. And one thing I think it's important to note is if the cost per kilowatt lowers on the rail belt, it will also provide a boon to rural Alaska, because the power cost equalization program has a ceiling on it of 75 cents, but the floor is established by the rate of Juneau, Anchorage, and Fairbanks. And so if we can lower that rate of cost per kilowatt, then that's going to make more, there's going to be more funding available for rural Alaska in the funding mechanism. So really, this is a win-win, and I'd just like to thank everybody. I'd like to thank Brian. I'd like to thank utilities, and especially the legislature, for their interest in this, is because, like I said, it's historic that we have all five utilities in the Alaska Energy Authority working together and partnering together to improve the grid. And with that, I want to thank you and turn the floor back to you, or to Mr. Hickey. Thank you.
Mr. Hickey, would you like to come forward and identify yourself, yourself on the record?
Good morning, Chair Rauscher and committee members. My name is Brian Hickey. I'm the Executive Director of Railbelt Regional Coordination. That is RRC, but it shouldn't be confused with the Railbelt Reliability Council, which also has that acronym. So I am not part of the Railbelt Reliability Council. I was on the board for a long time, but when we formed it. So I'll move through my presentation here. Thank Curtis for his introduction. He sort of teed up a lot of the subjects that I'll put forward and bring a little more clarity to. Just to kind of walk through what I'm planning on walking through today, and I'm be happy to take questions at any time. You all can hear me, correct?
Yes.
So I'll talk a little bit about Railbelt vision and alignment, which is unique right now. Why upgrading the grid matters. What our grid modernization and resiliency plan looks like. What the federal Grid Resiliency Innovation Partnership funding opportunity announcement means to us, and some expectation setting around that. And then finally, I'm going to talk about community benefit, which is a large part of the DOE's federal, I'll call it the GRIP, Grid Resiliency Innovation Partnership. I won't say those four words again. The GRIP and FOA, which is funding opportunity announcement, if that's all right. Part of the GRIP FOA is that we have to demonstrate community benefit. The administration has a Justice 40 initiative, and I'll talk a little bit about that. So just a little background, most of you, and this presentation I've used with our federal delegation, some of the folks at DOE, so some of the information in here is well known to all of you, and I'll try to not belabor that. But for those of you who aren't aware, the Railbelt grid is sort of in that blue, the blue circle right here. We do have three regions, the southern region, which is the Kenai Peninsula, the central region, which is by far the largest, is the Anchorage-Mat-Su area, and then the northern region up in Fairbanks. And then you do have the Copper Valley region, which is off to the east and is not connected to the rail belt at this time. As part of the GMRP, or the Grid Modernization Resiliency Plan, we would, in the final phase, look at an interconnection to that region. Just some fun facts, you know, 75% of Alaska's population lives in the rail belt. We generate about 80% of the electricity in the state. From Homer Electric to Fairbanks and down to Delta Junction is about 700 miles. And we have three single transmission lines, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. One of the key takeaways is with the current transmission grid, we can only move about 10% of our peak load from one region to another, and that's a single contingency situation. And what we mean by that is anytime one of those, that single line between Anchorage and the Kenai, is out of service, we are disconnected from Bradley Lake or any other resources that are on the Kenai. The same goes for the single line that goes from Fairbanks to the Mat-Su to Fairbanks. If that line's out of service for maintenance, we're disconnected and we can't use the resources that are south of that. A good example will be this summer, I believe Chugach will have the line between Anchorage and the Kenai out of service for about 2 months as they replace those towers between Bird to Gird, from Bird Point to Girdwood. So there'll be 60 days where you don't have access to the generation on the Kenai. One of the things that we'll talk about in this later is that we really need to have two lines between each region.
Representative Shrowey.
Can you go back to slide really quick?
That I'm going to have to figure out how you do that here.
Oh, that's all right. If you're not able.
There we go. Yeah.
Thank you. Through the chair, wasn't exactly sure when would be a good time to bring this up, but just with Mr. Thayer's remarks and then this visual, I didn't see a better spot to address this. So 75% of the population in the Rail Belt, obviously an investment, as has been talked about in prior committee hearings and is going to be talked about today, would be transformative. I also know that in Alaska's history, there's been concern over equity and making sure that we have investment throughout the state. And we're not just focusing on the 75% in urban or on the Rail Belt. Mr. Thayer mentioned that by bringing down energy costs along the Rail Belt, that would help direct funding towards PCE communities to rural Alaska. Has there been any sort, and maybe this is in the weeds and would be better as a follow-up answer to me, but I just wanted to get it in while I could. Has there been any sort of calculation as to, or projection as to, if we were to bring the cost of energy down 5 cents on the Rail Belt, how much would then, how much additional funding would go flow into rural Alaska? I just, something I'm thinking about as I think about equity and how we get a proposal like this through, I think we're going to need to have a lot of a buy-in throughout the diverse set of legislators we have in the Capitol. So just something I'd love to get more.
Representative Froggy, I think the correct sentence that he said was it would, he didn't use the word PCE, he used the matrix later on, is what I think is what he said, but I think you were right. He was hinting toward the PCE, but you should ask if that's exactly what he meant before you state that that's what he meant, because I think he said matrix later on.
Absolutely, and that's a good point, Chair Rauscher. Thank you for that. Nonetheless, I think you get my point. If we could get some more information on how much more funding would go into our more rural communities that aren't on the Rail Belt and how much and what the where it would go exactly, that'd be helpful in considering all this.
Absolutely.
Mr. Hickey.
Yeah, and I'll talk a little bit about that when I get to community benefit plan at the end. So we are, but I'll get to that. I'll make sure I make that point.
Thank you.
Okay, continue.
So we have a.
Any more questions? Everybody okay?
We have, Director Thayer alluded to, we have what I would call historic alignment on the Rail Belt. I've worked in the Rail Belt grid for almost 40 years. Maybe it's actually more than that, but I'm not going there. And I've never seen the utilities as aligned as they currently are. I think it's a statement towards, you know, both the boards and the CEOs, as well as the director of the Energy Authority and his board, that they brought us all together and we're actually moving in one direction, which is pretty amazing. We also brought the Regulatory Commission along. We had a meeting, we had a public meeting with them in January, and they agreed to be considered a team member on our on the state's filing of GRIP Topic 3, which I'll get to. And they've agreed to investigate what we would call innovative rate-making strategies that incent the construction of transmission and lower the cost of it. So that's a big step. So I think we have alignment both with the utilities, transmission owners, operators, as well as our regulators. So I think that's a, you know, to the degree they statutorily can, I believe their resolution was to the degree that they can statutorily support us in this, they've agreed to. So I think that's important. And we're seeking state and legislative leadership on this right now. I think I'll emphasize this a number of times, but this has to be the state's plan.
Okay, Representative Shrugge.
Is this the membership through the chair? Is this the membership of the RRC, not the council, but the your RRC? This these bullets here is
those are yeah. That's the what we were calling the team under the GRIP proposals is made up of those entities there.
Thank you.
Yep. And not to be confused with the Rail Belt Reliability Council, which of which some of us are part of that, but that's a different organization.
Good. All right. Continue. Thank you.
So, what is our vision? What we're proposing is it's a 12 to 15 year plan that would be transformational to the Rail Belt. We've done a fairly detailed estimate of what it would cost. We checked all the line miles and substations and everything that needed to be built, and the number comes out about $2.9 billion over the 15 years. 2.87 is the actual number, but it's a rough order of magnitude estimate at this point in time. There's a lot of study work that will have to be done. One thing that I mentioned earlier to one of the folks here is, as we move through this, every project that we do will be vetted through the NEPA process. And when, for those of you who've actually been through an environmental impact statement process, it's a very detailed process. Every stone is overturned. Every item is studied, all alternatives are evaluated, the economics are looked at. So while we have an overall plan that's based on the compilation of study work that's gone on since Bradley Lake was commissioned 32 years ago, there's been a lot of transmission studies that have gone on. every one of these lines and segments will be evaluated through the NEPA process before they're constructed. So this is a high-level plan, but, you know, every journey begins with one step, and that's sort of where we are right now. Phase one of the plan, which would build out the grid from Bradley Lake to a place called Lake Loraine, which is just northeast of Point McKenzie substation in the Matsu Valley. There is no station there right now, but it's a key point where some transmission lines come together, and there's been a station on the books to be built there for many years. It would build everything from Bradley Lake down near Kachemak Bay to Lake Loraine, including the existing system rebuilt, as well as a second intertie or a second line and high voltage DC submarine cable crossing Cook Inlet. And I'll show you that on a map here in a minute. One thing that's important to note is this build out, if we're going to move to a more fuel diverse, clean energy economy away from the way we've been doing business for the last 40 years, we are going to have to build out the transmission grid. There just is no, it's irrespective of what source that generation comes from, whether it's wind, solar, hydro, nuclear, carbon sequestered gas turbines, whatever the answer is, we need to build it out. And I'll just leave it at that, and I'll cover that in a little more detail later. One of the things that I think has been an interesting point that we've made with the folks back in D.C. is we're a very small grid here. We're a perfect little test bed for DOE to demonstrate how you could decarbonize a grid without spending the hundreds of billions of dollars it would take to do that in the three large regional grids in the Lower 48, ERCOT, the Eastern Interconnection, and the Western Interconnection. So we're presenting a win-win situation to DOE, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. So why it matters, it's something we should have done for a long time ago. We should have been working on for many years. We need more resiliency and reliability. Every time we take the Kenai line out of service, we island ourselves from Bradley Lake, and then we spend lots of Cook Inlet natural gas, which is in decline, making up for the hydroelectric we can't use optimally at that point in time. It will prepare the rail belt for a fuel diverse and clean future. It helps us. We'll be able to integrate non-dispatchable or variable renewable generation better. You'll see that we have three energy storage systems, one on the Kenai, one in the central region, one in Fairbanks. And the gains in efficiency we'll make from that will drive energy costs lower, which is good for the economy. And finally, to Representative Shragi's point, The PCE distribution to rural utilities is based in part on the average cost of rail belt electricity, the delta between that location's actual cost of energy and the rail belt's average cost of energy. If you lower the rail belt's average cost of energy, you increase that delta and more money flows that way. So that's how these benefits are pushed through the PCE funding formula out into the rural communities. And I'll hit your point towards the end because I have a slide on that.
Representative Proggs.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, two questions. One is this project, rail belt, regional, whatever it's called. Anyway, is this taking into consideration potential for the gas line to be built?
What I would say is that if the gas line were to be built and if you were to move to a hydrogen or ammonia economy, you need the transmission irrespective of what the source of fuel and generation is. So, yes, in that regard. It isn't tied to that any more than it's tied to wind, solar, nuclear. It's how you enable the system to be able to access these various sources, whether it's, hydrogen-fired generation on the west side of Cook Inlet being delivered to Fairbanks or to the Kenai. So. Mm-hmm.
The reason I'm asking that is that there's fuel diversification. If that's the goal, then yes, this is the way to go, I suppose. But there's also location diversification. In other words, theoretically, if the power was all provided from the middle of the grid, you would only need half the capacity one way or the other, which would lower the total transmission expenses. So is that being taken into consideration?
I think yes.
Okay. And the reason I'm concerned about that follow-up, sorry, is that there's some question about the ability, resource availability, basically minerals, to accomplish the grand goal of decarbonizing the economy, really. We're transferring reliance on hydrocarbon fuels right now, and eventually will be dependent on mineral availability. And I don't know that there's been enough consideration given to that particular problem. And if we haven't thought that through, then the whole goal becomes impractical, and then the pieces become impractical. So are we thinking about it on a high enough level is my concern.
Mr. Hickey, I've got a crazy question.
Okay.
It's a crazy question. So, I mean, there's no reality behind it. $1.3 billion for a transmission line. What if we were to buy 10 nuclear microreactors and set them up in the communities, that the large communities up and down the rail belt? Would we have then, instead of bringing in money for the transmission line upgrade, did that instead? Would that reduce the rate payer down to nothing almost, and would it be more money well spent? Or just trying to throwing that out there. I know it's, mm-hmm. it's vaguely will never happen, but it's the question of math here. Is that something that would actually work in theory?
Well, I believe that it goes back to the point that for a project like that to occur, whether it's a nuclear power or a large hydroelectric project, in order to create enough aggregated load to create the economy of scale to make it happen, you need to have all the utilities in the rail belt participating in it. And for them to all participate in it, they all have to have resilient access to each of those locations. And so I think at the end of the day, the transmission grid is critical to anything like that happening. You have to be able to, everybody has to be able to participate, and it has to have more than one line. Or the alternative is you have to put two of those microturbines everywhere, because when you take one down for maintenance, you have to have the other one standing by to pick up the load. So that's just sort of I won't get into the details, but fundamentally, when the grid was built out in the United States and in Alaska, it was built for reserve sharing for that purpose, so that you didn't have to put, if you had two locations, you didn't put four generators in, you put three in, and people had access to the third one when they needed it. So when you do something like that, you create a situation where you need the transmission grid. That's the short answer. Doesn't get you there without it.
Okay, thank you very much. I didn't mean to interrupt your...
No, not at all. That's what I'm here for. So appreciate the question. Good question.
I appreciate it. Go ahead.
So I think I covered everything there. These are some bullet points that we use back with our friends back in the federal government. But the rail belt grid is a small, fully functioning grid. It's a great testament. I mentioned that earlier. From the Justice 40 perspective, we have many tribes and disadvantaged communities who benefit from projects in the grid, as well as there are some large-scale advantages to decarbonizing the rail belt. You know, Anchorage International is the fourth largest air cargo airport in the world. I think they've used about 1.3 million gallons of jet fuel a day. Five critical military bases. We have rare earth mining to Representative Prox's point, and the Port of Alaska is a federally designated strategic port. So let me move on and kind of tell you where we got here and get to a little more of the meat of the presentation. There have been a confluence of events that have sort of brought us to this place. In September, the governor met with the five CEOs of the railway utilities and the director of the Energy Authority and challenged us to come up with and articulate a vision and a cost for what it would take to create a transmission grid that could serve whatever the future fuel-diverse clean energy economy is. And in concert with that, the basic infrastructure law, or the bipartisan infrastructure law, which is also sometimes known as the Infrastructure and Investment Jobs Act, the IIJA, had been passed, and the funding opportunities were under comment over the summer. So we had been working with the federal delegation and the Department of Energy on trying to figure out how to capitalize on that opportunity. The governor's message, we heard it loud and clear. That resulted in the Grid Modernization Resiliency Plan and the estimate that we constructed to determine what it would cost to actually build that project out. And I won't beat a dead horse, but if you build the GMRP, then rail belt utilities from and the citizens from Homer all the way to Delta Junction and everywhere in between can participate in whatever this clean energy future is. And we'd need to do that to drive costs down. We also have included energy storage in this. And I said earlier, there's an energy storage system in on the Kenai, which has already been constructed. There's one under procurement in the central region and one up in Fairbanks. So this is a map of what we're talking about. And I'll kind of walk through this very briefly, and then I'll talk about the three federal topic papers after that that cover that are identified by the RIR, which is the Rail Belt Innovative Resiliency Plan, the Rail Belt Backbone Reconstruction, and then the Battery Energy Storage Systems and their controls. This is Bradley Lake down here at the bottom. You kind of head up this way. Here, this is the central region, north up into Fairbanks, and over here to Delta Junction. The rust or red-colored lines are existing Rail Belt backbone lines, and they are under the federal applications that we're making. Rebuilding the Rail Belt backbone consists of rebuilding this red section of line all the way up to Fairbanks and down to Delta Junction. The yellow lines are new lines, which create the resiliency or the redundancy I was speaking to earlier. This is Soldotna right here, coming from Soldotna across Cook Inlet with a high voltage DC submarine cable, and then following the AKLNG right away up to Healy would create the second tie to Healy. That line has been studied and envisioned since Bradley Lake was constructed in the 1980s. In addition, there's the road belt intertie, which would be the final phase of this project out in the latter years of it, going from Wasilla out to Glen Allen and on up to the ground based missile defense at Fort Greely. That would tie the Copper Valley system into the rail belt grid, and also there is a potential hydroelectric project that's sort of a Bradley Lake size on an energy basis called the Tequila River Project, which is located right about where my cursor is there. That could be a helpful project that could help us, you know, in this transition away from Cook Inlet natural gas as that resource drops off.
Mr. Hickey, I was just wondering, is there a line from the yellow line to Anchorage somewhere in there that's not on the map?
Which I'm not following you.
So if you get to Anchorage from the new line on the left, the yellow line.
Yeah,
there's not on the map.
Well, there's actually this line right here. There are three 230 kV lines going from Beluga right into Point McKenzie right there.
Okay.
So that is Beluga is heavily interconnected.
Okay.
Because at one time Beluga was the largest power plant in the state before the latest rebuild. So yeah, that's heavily interconnected right there. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. I appreciate that.
And then we have the battery energy storage system. This is the one that's currently located at Soldotna. There'll be one located off of International in Minnesota in Anchorage, and then there's one in Fairbanks. The one in Fairbanks is being sized right now. The one in Anchorage is under procurement, and it's a joint project between MEA and Chugach, and the one on the Kenai is being has been installed. Homer put that in. And the blue C's you see there are, and we'll talk about that in GRIP Topic 2, are a control system that would be somewhat unique, probably unique in the U.S., where you would control these three batteries and this high-voltage DC line in real time with a single control system so that you can use that to optimize your ability to move power and minimize your reserves, which lowers your fuel burn, which lowers carbon production. So that's sort of the story with the overall plan. And now I'll talk a little bit about the three topic papers. So we took the larger plan and had to break it down into three separate projects that I referenced earlier so that it would fit into the funding opportunity announcement. Topic one is grid resilience, and that's rebuilding the existing backbone. Topic two is a smart grid, which is the control system that sits over the HVDC line and the three batteries. And topic four is grid innovation, which builds out the two redundant ties. One point is that topic three was actually, the state actually applied for that because they were the eligible entity under the funding opportunity announcement to apply for that. So the first two were applied for by MEA on behalf of the group, and the third one was applied for by the state on behalf of the group. So I think one thing I want to emphasize is that this plan has to be a state plan. It is financially beyond the ability of the Railbelt utilities to construct without unacceptable rate impacts. So it has to be a state plan. It does, we talked a little bit, it does benefit the entire state through the BP, through the PCE, through the Port of Alaska, through, you know, Anchorage International Airport. There's a lot of benefits. The economies of scale are necessary. And one point is that access to federal funding will be contingent on catalyzing state matching funds. And so we will be coming, if we are successful in one of our applications, we will be coming to the state for matching funds. That's part of the FOA process. I was just at a webinar yesterday. They emphasized you have to express that in your application, that the money DOE is going to put in is going to catalyze other money, other capital investments. So, and like we've covered this in too much detail, but irrespective of what generation source you use, if you're going to move away from what we're doing today, you're going to have to upgrade the transmission system. So let me do a little goal, a little expectation setting on federal money here. These grants are competitive that we're applying for. There were 700 concept papers submitted in December for the three topic areas. We were selected to move forward on topics one and two to an application, which is good news. Of the 289 concept papers that were submitted for topic one, only 144 people were asked to move forward. So we now have, and they're going to award 10 grants out of those 144 applications. So that kind of gives you an idea of where, you know, it's a very competitive process. Topic two, you can see there are 157 folks out of 326 were asked to move forward. We were one of those, but there are going to be 25 to 40 grants under that. So, you know, the federal money is not a sure thing. This has to be a state plan if we're going to do it. And finally, topic three, which the state applied for, we have not heard yet. That the first two were due on December 16th, and topic three was due January 13th. So we're waiting on to notice if we move forward under topic three. But I just want to do some expectation setting about how tough it's going to be to actually pull off these federal grants. Now moving on.
Representative McKay, you have a question?
No, I was just holding my glasses up. Sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
Thank you.
Sorry about that.
That's okay. I thought I saw you were ready to go for a question. Continue.
So bring you up to speed on where we are right now. There are five funding cycles under the GRIP FOA. Funding cycles one and two have been combined, and that's what we're applying for right now. There will be three more funding cycles in 23, 24, and 25. Fall of 23, fall of 24, and fall of 25. Those have been funded under the bipartisan infrastructure law. So this is our first funding cycle, and this just gives you an idea of what we've asked for funding for under this cycle, and that is to build out the red lines that you see that I'm running the cursor around right there, the additional work on the battery in Homer, the battery in the central region, the battery up north in Fairbanks, and the HVDC line, and then this line right here, which goes from a place called Lake Lorain that I mentioned earlier to Douglas, which is up near Willow, as well as this line that goes from Klutna hydroelectric facility around into hospitals. So those are that's what we've included in our first funding cycle application. In the middle of this line right here, Curtis alluded to it, Director Thayer from the Energy Authority, the utilities have bonded for $166.5 million to reconstruct a section of line right in here from Sterling Substation, which is just outside Soldotna, to Quartz Creek Substation, which is in Cooper Landing. That is the lossiest line section between Bradley Lake and the northern region. And the reason we're rebuilding that first is it will provide immediate benefits in reduction in losses. Through the chair.
Representative Brox?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, you talked about three different applications. Well, if we get one out of the three, how does that affect? Is it worth doing these one at a time with the risk that you don't get the others?
Through the chair, I believe if you begin with the premise that the work needs to be done and this is the state's plan, then yes, we're going to do these one way or the other.
Right, and I'm and with that premise that it's the state's plan. What we're doing is transferring the cost from the ratepayers to the state or to the federal government, and so we're not complaining as much about rate costs. Now we're complaining about taxes and lack of other state funding for child care, what have you. And we need to understand the consequences of just doing this part way and not being able to complete the entire 15-year concept project.
Sure. I believe that each of the projects brings incremental benefits as you move forward. For example, controlling just the Bez and the Kenai and in Anchorage would optimize transfers across the existing line. Not to the degree it would if you had the second line in place, because you don't have as much control. So, for example, the $166.5 million, of which 65% is dedicated to the Sterling to Quartz Creek line, that will reduce losses on Bradley Lake Energy by about 3 or 4%. That's 3% of 400 gigawatt hours a year. That's a significant at, you know, whatever we're paying, $70 a megawatt's the avoided cost per megawatt hour. So there are real benefits in each of these projects. Obviously, when you do the total project, the benefits are greater.
Right.
Follow up, Representative.
Follow up. Is the arithmetic performed and recorded somewhere? If this were a private corporation asking for investment, you would have a prospectus, and they would have to, they're required to analyze the risks associated with it and then do the arithmetic so that you can figure out the risk versus reward for an investment. And we're talking very high level here without the arithmetic. And is the arithmetic included somewhere?
Sure. Through the chair, those type of production costing studies, or what we call them in economics, will be evaluated in the NEPA process as you move through the environmental impact statement. So if you don't meet that, you don't pass the bar on an EIS. So at this point in time, the overall economics have not been evaluated. If that's your question at this today.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you,
Representative Strage.
Thank you, Chair Rauscher. I had two questions, but my first one was exactly along the lines of Representative Prox, which is, you know, you just underscored the fact that all of these proposals would require state match. And, you know, I think we've got a lot of plans for spending. I don't think we necessarily know how, A, if we'd be successful in these applications, and B, if we are, I don't know what revenue looks like next year or how we would fund those things. We don't have savings. And historically, we've turned to reducing the amount of the dividend to make up for deficits or when we want to make these sorts of investments. And so while we might be taking the risk away from the ratepayer, are we then going to take dividends to make these investments, which is a hit to ultimately the ratepayer? And so there's all these trade-offs. So just to underscore, I think Representative Prox brings up a really good concern about what happens if we only get one or two of these done because our applications are not successful, or because we just don't have the funding for it. A little bit of concern there. Maybe the second question that I had that I'll hit on if the chair would allow me is, I know we're currently looking at spending cap proposals in the legislature. Would these sorts of investments fall underneath a spending cap or the spending caps that are proposed? Because my understanding is now the spending caps that are being proposed would actually cause us to reduce current spending further. And so would we be able to make this sort of investment if these spending caps were to pass? And maybe you don't know the answer, but I thought I'd ask.
That is outside my area of expertise, so I can't speak to that.
Okay, thank you. So yeah. It'd be a good thing to find out, I think.
You good here?
I'm good, yeah. Thank you.
Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the chair. I'm curious, are the projects, or is there a list somewhere of, you kind of just touched on a question I had, which was, whether these projects are in any way modular. In other words, if we do one project, can it be sort of self-sustaining without any guarantee of funding down the road for future parts of the overall goal of the project? But is there a list somewhere of priorities in terms of energy transmission capability, output, et cetera, in terms of most beneficial down, so that if the legislature were to say partially fund or partially support this effort, we would know where to place mm-hmm. the investment?
We are working on putting that together for these applications. We have, I guess what I'd say is there have been a number of studies that have been done in the rail belt over the last 30 years about transmission upgrades, going back to the Bradley Lake project. And in developing the GMRP, we took those studies, which were done for different purposes, and we sort of amalgamated them into this larger plan. And so all that work is going to have to be done. I think the folks who are the transmission engineers understand where the priorities are, because it's just kind of common knowledge in our industry. Like, for example, we're working on certainly the Quartz Creek because it's the lossiest line section. Everybody just knows that. But it's never been formalized. And so what we're working on is we are working on formalizing that and putting that in a prioritized list with costs, because we understand that coming forward, if there is an ask, you all are going to have to understand what it is we're doing. So it's a great question. Thank you. And we are working on it. I do want to emphasize that the funding opportunity announcement came out on November 18th, and we had to have the concept papers done by December 16th and January 13th. So it was a long holiday, a long holiday season, and we did manage to get them filed, but a lot of the work still remains to be done. So,
follow-up, Representative?
Yeah, and just through the chair, do we have, I guess, I don't see funding amounts in these slides. So for the different sort of modular pieces of this interconnectivity, do we have pretty good numbers on what these would cost and what would be expected from the state once we know what we can expect from federal dollars?
We know on a line section and substation level what the costs are. We compiled those to call what I refer to as phase one, which is really the build out from Bradley Lake as far north as Lake Lorain. We compiled those to create what we called phase one, which is that comes out at about $1.26 billion. That gets you as far north as the central region. So we have that detail. Once again, it's and we're putting it together in a more presentable format. Let me put it that way. The detail exists in spreadsheets and the work that we've been doing, but it hasn't been formalized yet. So we are working on that as part of the application process.
Representative? Okay. Everybody okay? All right, continue.
Sure. I won't spend a lot of time on this, but and this is primarily, we put these slides in for the folks back east, but it's just expressing that, you know, Alaska is a diverse place. We all know that. There certainly is plenty of room for Justice 40 initiative passing the benefits of energy to disadvantaged communities. I think we have a lot of opportunities to do that. To Representative Shragi's question through the chair, we are in the process of bringing on a consultant to develop a community benefit plan, and the analysis that you brought up will be part of that plan, and it will be submitted as part of our application. The community benefit plan is common to the three FOA topics. So we're having somebody work on that. You know, we did a high level hit at it between November and December in 2 weeks, and we're trying to fill out and flesh that out. And so that type of analysis will be done by the consultant, hopefully in the very near future, given that the next one is due March 13th, actually. Due the 17th, but they want it 3 days early, is what they tell you. So we'll be pulling those numbers together here in the next couple of weeks.
Thank you.
Follow up, Representative? So I do. You said it would be a couple of weeks, you say? So I was just wondering.
Let me say by March 13th.
March 13th. Okay.
One way or the other.
I was just wondering, where did the data come from? I mean, where have you collected the data from?
We have not. That's what we're doing, is collecting the hard data. We know there are 200 tribes. We know that they speak 110 languages in the school district. We know that the five most diverse census districts in the country were in East Anchorage in 2015. Now we really have to pin down, so which tribes are actually in the rail belt, get all the detail for that. So that's what this consultant we're engaging will be doing for us.
Well, very good. Thank you very much. Continue, sir.
I won't go into detail on the last slide. It talks about military bases, but I think that's important to the folks back east for the national interest. So here's where we are on the grant selection process and timing. So topics 1 and 2 were due on the 16th, and they were filed. These were concept papers. And the concept paper on topic 3 was filed timely on the 13th, actually on the 9th. We've been selected to apply on topics 1 and 2, and we're waiting for selection to determine whether we'll be selected on topic 3. Just to give you a rough idea, topic 1, we're looking at trying to get a grant of probably in the neighborhood of $50 to $70 million. It's formulated by statute that it is $100 million or your three-year average spend on the lesser of $100 million or your three-year average spend on grid resiliency. That's what the statute says. So we haven't pulled together our three-year spend yet, but somewhere my guess is we'll end up in that $50 to $70 million range. That particular one, because we would be small utilities, has a 30% match. Topic 2, we're looking for about $15 million, and that's the control system, and that has a 50% match. And then topic 3 is really the big one, which the state was the applicant for. That's the new interties. That's about, we're looking for $300 million in this funding cycle, which is a 50% match. So that would be a $300 million match. You know, all told, if, and I want to set expectations, if we were to get all three of them, which is a very big if, the match is around $400 million. And just so you have an idea that we have an idea of where we're going with this, it's important to understand that in the application process, we will have to identify how costs will be allocated. And so our intention is to identify, that we would seek matching funds from the state subject to legislative approval. And if there is a difference that isn't made up, we would seek funding from the utilities subject to board approval. That's what our cost, and now we are bound by that once we, if we were to be selected and if we were to get to a place where we were going to negotiate an agreement with DOE, we would be bound by what we said in this application. So we're not binding ourselves to any financial commitment, but we are binding ourselves to a way we would deal with a financial commitment if one arose in the negotiation process, which, as you can see there, selection notification occurs in the summer of 2023 for the first two and then in the fall for topic 3. And then award negotiations take, it appears by the schedule they put out, it take about 6 months, and they occur in fall of 23 and the winter of 23. So that's sort of the timing for, that's when we would have to make commitments as to what we were going to do, would be out in that time frame. Interestingly, that is overlapping the next funding cycle. So not only would you, if you were selected, would you be working the negotiations on that, you'd also be applying for funding in the second or the third cycle.
Representative?
Thank you, through the chair. So we're bound by the proposal that we put forward, should it be accepted. Or just out of curiosity, are we allowed to put a little asterisk in there that says, you know, subject to state oil revenues and the amount of the dividend? A little bit of a facetious question, but I mean, the issue of we don't really have a plan for, we don't know what state revenues are going to look like in the next few years and how we're going to meet the revenue needs to be able to make these sort of spending decisions. And it just makes it really challenging when evaluating these 3 or even longer year plans. And I think this would be transformative to the rail belt. How do we make those plans? I don't know today. It's hard.
Through the chair. Thank you. Yeah. If I could comment on that, I mean, we're in a very similar chicken and egg situation doing these applications. I think our process so far has been, let's get invited to the dance. We've been invited to 2 of the dances. Then let's see if somebody wants to dance with us. And if they do, then we can make a decision whether we want to dance or not. But if we don't get to the place where we get asked to dance, we never even get to make that decision. So I completely understand where you're coming from. I'm wrestling with that right now and how I phrase this language, because I think they would like something more specific than we are able to give them.
Maybe just one more comment, and appreciate the chair for all his indulgence today.
Follow up. Go ahead.
Just thank you for your hard work on this effort. I mean, it gives us the option to evaluate and should we have the revenue and be accepted for these sorts of things. I think it could be very terrific for the state. So thanks for your hard work on this. I hope you don't take my comments as derogatory or,
Not in the least.
To these plans.
Not in the least. I think that's everything I've got. So any questions? I'm happy to answer them, obviously.
From the members?
I've got one more, but I want to.
Representative Carey.
I have one more, too, and this is a really basic question. We talked about energy storage last week on the Rail Belt, and I'm not an energy expert. I'm working really hard to learn a lot more, but it seems to me that the energy storage is a different concept if we're talking about natural gas, if we're talking about renewables. So when you mentioned the transmission and potential to upgrade with renewables later, does that involve additional storage requests or additional storage capacity or any other sort of considerations in, I get that it would make it easier to upgrade to renewables, but I'm curious what some of the challenges might be even with this project.
Sure. Through the chair, I think there maybe are two or three questions there, and I'll try to parse them out. There are multiple methods for energy storage. There are batteries, which is sort of an obvious short-term storage right now. You can get maybe 4 hours out of a large-scale battery. Those cost hundreds of millions of dollars. But so there's battery energy storage. There's the ability to store energy in the ponds of the hydroelectric projects. Our hydroelectric projects are what they call lake and penstock. So there's a lake and a tunnel down to a powerhouse. As you generate with renewable and you cut back your schedules on the hydroelectric, you're effectively storing that renewable energy behind the dam in the form of water. There's stored energy in the form of gas storage, SINGSA, which is representative of the Cook Inlet. Can't remember what SINGSA stands for, but it's our gas storage facility on the Kenai. So there are multiple ways that you can store energy. There's research being done on long-term battery, iron flow batteries. There's a lot of money pouring into trying to do longer term storage, but really I think those things are still on the drawing board. So energy storage that we're contemplating in this particular project, its first use, which would limit its ability during some times of the year to be used to integrate renewables, is for grid stabilization. We have some challenges that have risen over the last few years on maintaining system frequency, and I won't get into the details, but it has to do with the changes in generation and non-dispatchable renewables that we've put on the grid. It moves things around. So the first use of the energy storage systems is that. A secondary use, and those events only occur during certain times of the year, so when it's not being used for that, it could help integrate renewables into the grid. But there is a point where you will have used up that energy storage in its combination with the storage we can do in the hydroelectric projects too, and you would have to, at some point in time, add more energy storage. So it's both yes and no. It would help us, but it's, at some point, you've used up all the energy storage you have, and, you start moving the system frequency around, you have to go back and start over again. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you. More or less. It's a complicated subject, and just was interested in sort of the ability to upgrade later, since you had mentioned that would be a long-term benefit of this work.
Representative Shruggy, you said you had one more.
Yeah, last question. Thank you, Chair Rauscher. So a concern combined with a question. I understand we're working under a very tight deadline to potentially be eligible for some federal funding. Again, for very good use and could be very beneficial to the state. I also know that, we have a Rail Belt Reliability Council that is supposed to be doing a lot of long-term planning that has been set up to have a structure that has a lot of public stakeholder and public interest type membership involved in that process. I also know that this could, in some ways, not in a nefarious manner, but subvert or, work around some of what the RRC might otherwise do on their own. And I know they're not quite stood up to be able to undertake this. So all this is to say I have some concern that the plans that are being developed don't have a lot of public input. And I know that some of the more progressive administrations, namely this one, typically has a lot of concern over what is that public impact? How much have we brought everyone to the table to make sure that this is a plan that the state as a whole supports? Do you see any concern there? Is that one of the criteria by which these plans are judged? And is there any plan to address that down the line or bring in some of that public input? Again, not to say any of this is nefarious, but it is just a concern I have in the back of my head, and I was hoping you could shed some light on how to think about that.
Sure, absolutely. Through the chair, thank you for the question. It's a great question. We've wrestled with it. I do, you know, and as you are well aware, I was instrumental in working SB 123 and was on the setting up the RRC, worked on it for many, many years. So I'm fairly familiar with that organization and how it came to be. I think that I'll start with saying absolutely when that organization is stood up and technically ready to participate, this will be, you know, this plan should be handed off to them. That this is what they should do. But they are quite a ways from that day. Even once they staff up, which will take some time, and then they get their folks trained to actually do what they need to do, there are several hundred pages of reliability standards that they're going to have to go through and approve and adopt before they can start an integrated resource plan. And then the integrated resource planning process will, my guess is, take, given that the first IRP will be probably somewhat controversial as we kind of learn our way through this in a stakeholder-driven process. So I think you're a number of years out before that is actually going to come to fruition. I was part of the group in the beginning that initiated those conversations back in 2013. And we always felt that would be, we were going to be building the plane while we were flying it. We weren't going to be able to set the plane down, turn the lights off, and build the organization and take back off again. So I think we're facing one of those moments where that group is in sort of in a nascent phase and is coming into fruition. And as soon as they are ready, you know, absolutely, that's where this resides. I would say, so that's sort of from the organizational standpoint. I think from a technical standpoint, building out any level of transmission just increases the options in an integrated resource plan. You're less constrained. And so it really, and the labyrinth of transmission lines that need to be built on the rail belt is well known. It's been studied for 40 years. You know, the voltage classes might be different, whether it's 2115s or 0230. You know, there's some details, some nuance that may be different, but that labyrinth is well known. And so I'm confident that where we're moving is a place they would move when they are ready to take the ball and run with it. And I know we're going to, you know, I'm no longer on the governing board, but I go to the governing board meetings periodically and update them on what we're doing here, because it's important to keep the group involved. But until that organization is stood up and can actually do what they need to do, we'll, you know, we have to keep flying the plane. And so I hopefully answered your question there. But certainly nothing nefarious, and certainly we're not trying to end run the RRC. We just need them to come up to speed, and we're working that issue in parallel, so, and they will.
And absolutely, through the chair, absolutely understand all of that. And if you are to do something outside of the RRC, I think transmission makes a lot of sense. It does facilitate a lot of other investment down the line that the RRC could, you know, direct.
Yep.
It would be nice to see some stakeholder or some public engagement in this process, which I don't think I've seen yet. But I want to just, again, thank the chair for his indulgence today. I asked a lot of questions, and I appreciate you being here to answer questions.
One other comment, just through the chair, I would say that, and as I stated earlier, once we go into the NEPA process for any one of these elements, that is a very public process. There is no, you know, you have a lead agency from the federal government, and they hold meetings with all the stakeholders. So, you know, there is no way we're going to get around that, or we are not trying to get around that. We know that that's something we need to do. So thank you for the question.
Thank you, and thanks again to the chair.
You bet, Representative. Thank you. And, you know, I just wanted to ask, federal dollars are always promised, and they take a long time before they get here. Should everything go like clockwork for on our side, trying to help you with your applications there? What's your ETA on actually getting the funding, and then what is the ETA on actually competing or completing the projected projects?
I mean, whoop, that wasn't what I meant to do. That's not what I meant to do either. There we go. Right. There we go.
Oh, that was it there. Okay.
Yeah, I just wanted to, might be easier to look at it on the slide here. You know, award negotiations would occur in the fall of 2023 and the winter of 2023 for the phase one, for what we've asked for on the second map that I showed you.
Right.
And so that work would then, you know, at that point you begin the NEPA process, right? And so that's, you know, that's a 3 to 5 year process between starting NEPA process and actually completing construction. So phase one is sort of in that 1 to 5 year time frame, and then these leapfrog going out. You know, you're starting, you're permitting projects while you're building, and I say elements of the project while you're building other elements in parallel.
27, 28.
Well, for completion of some of the beginning projects, which when, you know, so it's a very, you know, transmission lines take a long time to build. Okay. There's a lot of permitting. There's a lot of stakeholder
involvement. Especially where you're headed, you got to go through where you're going. Yep. It's not, you're not just upgrading a line that exists. I'm following it.
And... Yep.
So, any more questions for the committee? Well, I thank you for defining the ask, so we get an idea of what you're asking, and refining the elements therein, and coming here to help answer our questions, taking up our invitation.
Thank you very much.
We appreciate the details. We anticipate the coming projections in March. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if Mr. Thayer is still online. He'd like to have a closing remark or two, but I'll just offer it. If you're not there, that's fine.
No, I am here. I am here to the bitter end, Mr. Chair. No, I just want to thank the committee members. As you can see, there's just a lot of moving parts. And really, to where we are today, it's just, like I said, it was historic that we have the alignment. But from when this federal funding became available to what we were able to, the team was able to do by all the utilities and submit, it's nothing but record pace. And like I said, hopefully we're going to be receiving some federal funds to help help the ratepayers and help upgrade our system from a 30 to 40 year old system into newer technology. So again, thank you, and I thank you for the committee's interest in the subject.
Well, we thank you both. So we thank everybody. Our next scheduled meeting will be Thursday, the 16th of February at 10:15 a.m., where we'll hear HB 62 from Representative Edgman. And I'll remind you, I have set an amendment deadline for tomorrow. Pretty quick.
No, I think next Wednesday. Huh? I thought the email said next Wednesday. Is this
Wednesday? It is this Wednesday.
Brief it easy, if we could.
Yeah. All right, I appreciate it. We're back online here. I'm going to hold off on an amendment deadline at this point, okay, so we at least hear the bill. And Wednesday the 15th was projected, but we're going to go hold off on that. It's my intention to hear from the bill sponsor to hold public testimony and have no further business today before the committee. We're adjourned at 11:20.